You're listening to this week's episode of Macquarie Street Matters, a podcast about the personalities and events in the New South Wales Parliament here in Sydney with Alistair Hinskins. Well, I'm very happy this week to have Wendy Tuckerman, my good friend and the member for Goulburn, join me on Macquarie Street Matters. Welcome, Wendy.
It's an absolute pleasure, and how very honoured I am to be on your podcast.
Now, look, don't overdo
which appears to be absolutely at the forefront of everyone's mind, particularly in Parliament. So congratulations, and let's make it happen.
Thank you. You can come back if you get a start like that. You're welcome. You're welcome. Now, Wendy, you came into Parliament in 2019, but before you came into Parliament, you're one of the members of our team that have had a very rich and interesting life beforehand. I don't think I've ever asked you this before, but where did you grow up?
I grew up in Canberra. Oh. I was born in Cara. My family come from Cara, both my mother and father. And Dad moved to Canberra when I was very young. I think I was about two. And for work. And
wonderful. Now, a little known fact of yours, I'm going to embarrass you now, is that you were in the Australian schoolgirls hockey team.
Indeed. And it was a great honour. Hockey was my passion during my childhood, and was very lucky to represent the ACT for a long, long time. And that started right from the age of six, I think, when I first started, to probably my last game of hockey may have been around 40.
What position did you play?
Well, it varied. Centre-half, back at those stages, so defenders, yeah, so
that must have been a great experience, and probably not easy. I'm now talking up your achievement, because in my experience of sport, it's much easier to get selected in national teams if you come from one of the major states than from somewhere like the Australian Capital Territory. So quite an achievement.
Yeah, no, I'm a bit of a sport freak, and really enjoyed my little foray in that respect. And now I love golf, but don't seem to play golf very often these
enough days.
Yeah.
Now, you finished school. You're obviously a sporty young woman. And did you go straight into the Australian Federal Police?
Yeah, I did. 18, I actually entered the Australian Federal Police Force and had almost 15 years in the force. And it was a wonderful experience and a life-changing experience.
Now, presumably, how long after general duties did you go into the detective branch?
Oh, look, I think I was only in general duties less than 2 years, and a part of that two-year period was actually in what was called at the time the Juvenile Aid Bureau, which focused on children at the time, sexual assault, child abuse, neglect. And from there, it started my introductory into investigation. And then the AFP embarked on a more considered effort into managing sexual assault and child abuse, and was the first police force in the nation to have a unit specifically for that reason, which would investigate and go through the whole system and make sure that the complainants were supported through court. And that actually saw an increase in conviction and success in those matters. And it was very unique in that it took the whole unit away from a police station. So, and previously we would have to attend hospitals, scientific bureaus for complainant to go through that process, but we housed it all in one area, and we bought the doctors, scientific, and we did all our investigation. We had facilities where the complainant could, you know, have a shower, have a sleep, you know, prior to asking questions, and the complainant was the focus, and it was very, very successful, and I'm very proud of being an inaugural member of that particular unit. So I did that. That was really my specialty in my investigation career, and yeah, no, it was very rewarding.
Some of the legislation that and some of the reforms that the New South Wales Coalition Government, before it went into opposition, brought in included special ways of child sexual victims could give evidence by a recording, a video recording. And we announced just prior to the election this year that that would be expanded throughout the state after a pilot which had taken place in two locations within the state to all district courts and all prosecutions throughout the state. And I must say, you know, Wendy, I was mainly a civil lawyer, but certainly you would interact with the victims of child sex abuse, and it had such profound impacts, lifelong impacts on those victims. So it's a particularly...
And it's so important, that process in regards to attending court and making it easier for the complainants to be able to go through that process, because it is such a life-changing experience, and to really assist them in getting through that. You know, I'm so pleased that has been expanded, because there's so much work to do in that area, and it's unfortunately, you know, a very, very difficult job.
It is. I must say, I think people in this place from time to time probably feel as if I'm cross-examining them. But there are times when I feel like I'm being questioned by Detective Tuckerman, I must say, when you've got, you know, when you want information, and I just get I mean, it's a particular training. It's a very valuable life experience and skills that you're able to bring.
And a great skill for my role now as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a lifelong skill. And it takes a lot of training, and it is, you know, I absolutely loved the job that I did, and it really has guided me, you know, going forward in all sorts of ways. So, you know, and it's one of the things that you learn is actually listening, you know, the skill of listening. And I feel that that's such an important tool in communication, and, you know, I really think it's been of such value in the role that I have now.
It is, because also as a barrister, you know, you're really taught that you must listen to the answers, because that often gives you the most relevant and pertinent next question. And I also think that that's been, you know, a really valuable skill to be able to logically question, you know, whether it's as a minister and you're asking bureaucrats, or whether it's stakeholders or whoever, just to get on top of the information. As you know, there's a great volume of information we have to get on top of as MPs, and having those, as you say, questioning and listening skills are incredibly valuable. So you, at some point, you got married, you have two children who are now grown up, and you now got grandchildren.
Yeah, indeed.
And before you came to Macquarie Street, you were very civically minded. You were mayor of Boorowa, and you had other sort of engagements. One of the interesting political quirks of your history is that you actually bought the farm of the former Deputy Premier.
Indeed, Ian Armstrong.
Ian Armstrong.
Yeah, so my husband and I decided that we'd move away from Canberra, and we bought the farm. And yeah, Ian and Jenny and the family used to live on the farm, and we've had them visit, you know, prior to Ian's death. And yeah, it's a remarkable history, actually. But that was the best move that we ever made. In the decision was in regard to raising our kids, and the community of Boorowa is such a beautiful community, and it was really a life-changing move, and never look back. It's been a great experience being a farmer as well, and just on the journey, it's just another life experience that's helped me form the person who I am today, and certainly my representations of the local communities in my electorate, which is predominantly, there's a lot of agriculture in our communities, and, you know, it's an important part of the work I do.
Ian Armstrong's son Angus was actually a friend of mine at university. He was in the same year of mine at university, and look, I didn't know Ian Armstrong. I met him a couple of times, but his son Angus was just the most great person. So I'm sure that's a reflection of the family and
yeah, and Angus has brought his children back out to the farm. So, you know, you're right. They're a beautiful family and a great career of serving the community. He was a great man.
There was a great story at his funeral of the way in which he took Gladys Berejiklian under his wing when she first came into Parliament and showed her regional New South Wales, because he thought that she was someone that was going to have a future in politics, and therefore it was important to let her know about parts of New South Wales that she had never experienced growing up in Sydney.
And Gladys, I remember, visited Boorowa Council at the time when I was mayor as the Shadow Minister for Transport, and she was very engaged with the challenges that regional New South Wales has in public transport. So, yeah, the wheel turns.
Now, you've had two elections for the seat of Goulburn, 2019, 2023, both difficult elections, but you wanted to continue your public service by coming into Macquarie Street. How have you found it?
Yeah, it's been originally, like 2019 was, you know, quite challenging just to work out. I hadn't been particularly engaged in what was happening in New South Wales Parliament other than through representations as a mayor, but just, you know, finding out how the system works, building relationships and how that all works. It's all been very interesting, but I must say that I really enjoy being up in the Parliament, but equally enjoy getting back home.
Well, you've got a truly diverse but beautiful electorate with many beautiful spots. It's quite a challenge, isn't it, being a regional MP? You've got large geographical areas that you've got to cover.
Yeah, indeed. And there's a lot of travel involved, getting to local communities, understanding the issues. And as you said, it's very diverse. We go from farming communities to small villages, right through to the highlands and beyond. So all sorts of different issues. And, you know, it's important that you're across all those sorts of different issues and the challenges that are being faced by regional and rural communities. And that's why I'm really proud to be a Liberal member as well, because I think it's important, and I know that my colleagues in the National Party do a great job representing regional areas, but it's important to have someone at the table within the Liberal Party that also can, you know, influence debate and any legislation that may arise through that affect regional and rural communities. So it's important to have that balance also within the Liberal Party.
Yeah, no, and it's incredibly valuable. As you say, we work well with the National Party, but our regional Liberals are incredibly important too. I must say, I visited you on a number of occasions in your electorate, and quite apart from the fact that you seem to be very well regarded by your constituents, to my observation, but I was really impressed by the sense of community and, you know, some of the pieces of infrastructure that we were able to open that you'd advocated for strongly for your communities that you're able to deliver was really enjoyable. It was great to come into the electorate.
Yeah, and such a beautiful part of the world. Anyone that visits my electorate just really enjoys the experience and certainly understands the challenges. But, you know, we're very lucky. Communities within regional areas, communities that stick together and really support each other, especially in great times of need. And we've certainly had some challenges over the last term of government. And, you know, I don't think any MPs really experienced what happened in the last term. As a new parliamentarian, it was certainly a challenge.
So when you came in, I've reread your inaugural speech, which I heard you deliver when you came in. But, you know, at the time that you started in Parliament, the drought was a historic drought. And then we've had, you know, bushfires and COVID, and I'm not sure if your areas received floods as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's been this full gamut of challenges. It's been a pretty exhausting 4 years.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not over yet. We're heading into another drought. A lot of areas are already experiencing drought conditions, and it's going to be a big challenge going forward. And I hope the government, the current government, are up to it. because, and they need to be prepared because the impacts that drought has on communities, the agriculture business and the economy is enormous, and they have to start focusing on what that means. And cuts to things like the Rural Assistance Authority and a number of departments is not going to help.
Yeah, the MINS Labor government seems to have been particularly hard on regional areas. We've got the seniors' travel cards have been cut. Yep. You know, active kids. I know that sport is a big part of regional communities, active kids being cut and so on. How is the cost of living pressures, you know, impacting your electorate?
Oh, look, it's enormous. And, you know, those active kids vouchers, creative kids vouchers really gave the opportunity to young people to be a part of the community and be part of sporting organisations, to explore the wonderful advantages of learning music and theatre and those sorts of things. And, you know, I listened to your podcast with Kelly Sloan, and she really nailed it in regards to that sense of community that you get by engaging young people in those sorts of activities and the importance of that. And, you know, our community will definitely feel it. And what goes around comes around. Obviously, those vouchers supported our local small businesses. And, you know, that's no longer there for the majority of people.
Mm. I visited, I think, two TAFEs in your electorate. At Goulburn TAFE, I think it was, plumbing had been reintroduced, which had been cut about 30 years. This was all off the back of our record investments in TAFE. You know, the TAFE budget was over $2 billion in the last coalition budget before the government changed $3 billion, more than $3 billion on skills and training generally. But then we went to one of those, a much smaller TAFE in your electorate. And it was really interesting that I think it was wool classification had been introduced for the first time at that TAFE. And so there was this sense that TAFE was, you know, really doing well under the coalition, you know, contrary to the carping of the Labor government, that we'd been running down TAFE. And of course, what was the first thing they did when they got into government? Labor cut the TAFE budget and cut expenditure on skills and training in this most recent budget.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that small businesses are challenged with, is skilling people to do the work that they need to do. There's such a shortage out there, and COVID's obviously impacted that, and it's important that we have the right amount of funding to be able to, you know, ensure that the people that are looking for jobs are skilled to do them, and that we're meeting those niches that are being left behind.
So you're the Shadow Minister for Small Business. What are the big front of mind issues for you in terms of small business other than skills and training?
Well, it's that cost. It's the cost. We're seeing energy increased. We've seen in the budget that they're increasing registration fees, license fees, all those little things impact on the cost of doing business for small business. And, you know, if you don't have that flow, that extra bit of money that may have been, you know, supported by active kids vouchers, creative kid vouchers, mum and dad could then go and spend on other businesses within the community, that all impacts.
It's going to pinch.
Absolutely. Mm. And we're now facing, you know, a drought, which, let me tell you, the farmers actually, you know, they support local businesses in our communities. If they don't have the extra cash because of the impacts of drought, yeah, we're headed for some pretty concerning times for our communities.
Mm. Now, the other area that you're Shadow Minister for, and indeed you were Minister before the election, local government, you came to that role with great experience, having been a mayor and being a councillor. What are some of the things that you're most proud of, and what are some of the big challenges that you see in local government at the moment?
Yeah, look, you know, I think there's certainly a lot of challenges in regards to code of conduct around councillors. We endorse recommendations from a code of conduct inquiry, and, you know, we left it, unfortunately, didn't have enough time to actually put those recommendations into action. But we were hoping that, you know, if we did get back into that, was going to be a priority of our government going forward, because it's important that we have that stability in local government that you know, will best serve the communities. And
it's all about integrity. Absolutely. And good behaviour, isn't it?
Yeah. And ensuring that, you know, that integrity is right through council, and, you know, that the community has the confidence in councillors to be able to do the job that they need to do. So I'm waiting to see where that progresses with the new minister. There has been a budget allocation of 4.6 million, I think, but it's been flagged around financial and the conduct inquiry. So we'll see where that ends up. And I know that the sector are very keen to see where it ends up, because I think they're a bit frustrated with the processes at the moment. And of course, those processes are really costing a lot of money for communities. So it's important, and I do hope that the minister, you know, does make those changes, and we see a lot more effective local governments in our communities.
Well, I must say there are so many services, and particularly in regional communities, local government is such an important tier of government.
Absolutely, and they're financially impacted. You know, this is the other important piece of work that the new minister has to do in regards to, well, how do we make our council sustainable? And they're meeting a lot of challenges, whether it's the emergency service levy, which has gone up so much. And that's why the previous government, you know, met the costs of those increases for the last 3 years, and the new government has decided not to. So this is impacting hugely on council's bottom line. And we're now seeing enormous amount of councils actually looking at doing special rate variations, which at the end of the day will be an enormous cost to the ratepayer.
So Labor says on the one hand they won't increase taxes, which of course is a broken promise directly by them, but also indirectly they strangle the financial affairs of councils by giving them less money and putting a bigger impost on local government, which then means that local government's increasing rates or applying to increase rates.
And I'm not saying the emergency service levy is an easy problem to solve. It's not. Mm-hmm. It certainly needs some reconsideration, because at the end of the day, it's our communities that are being impacted by service level increased costs, and it's something that needs to be tackled.
Yep. Wendy, one of the local issues that you and I had a little bit to do with when we were in government was Wakefield Park, which is, of course, not only a facility in your local electorate and a difficult issue to manage, but it also had broader interest from the whole of the state. I had constituents in my electorate saying that they go and take cars down to Wakefield Park as well. There was this sort of difficult issue of noise for the local residents against the commercial impact on Goulburn of not having the raceway operate. And of course, in a sense, it was a local government issue, but the state government was being looked at as the...
trying to solve the problem. Yes. On behalf of, you know, the motorsporting industry. And it was a difficult problem to solve, because we had a private owner that operated Wakefield Park that weren't really engaging with the local community around the noise issues, and it ended up in court, in the local environment court. And
it was a bit of a own goal, wasn't it? Because the former owners took it to the Land and Environment Court and then got a result which was possibly worse than they started with.
Absolutely, and it was going to make it more difficult for them to be a viable operation. So yeah, it certainly became my problem to fix, and it certainly was very challenging, particularly leading up to the election. But
sorry to interrupt you, but one of the things that I really kind of admired was, although from time to time I was a bit of a sounding board, I thought it was fantastic the way that you really, you know, fought hard to get a result for the community. You know, you recognised that people felt strongly about it. And do you want to just sort of talk us through how you went about solving a concrete local issue or improving a local issue?
Yeah, one of the issues was obviously that the confidence that I had to maintain from discussions with business, and that was difficult because the community and the supporters of Wakefield were looking for answers, you know, what can we do? But obviously those discussions, there was a lot of commercial issues that I had to keep to myself, and the owners were at the time, you know, not able to be able to put into the raceway the funding that was needed to be able to improve
the capital investment
and to get racing again. And so, you know, there's a lot of discussion with the previous owners, and you know, through that discussion and through discussion with a couple of business leaders in the community, we came up with a proposal for another person to look at purchasing. And we were lucky that actually came through. But there was a lot of discussion in the meantime between the owners and the potential new owner about costs and taking over the business. So during that time, it really went down to, you know, just prior to the election where that issue was solved. And, you know, it was a great result. It was a great result for the community. It was a great result for motorsporting industry, because it's such a significant of the motorsporting industry. And now we have an owner that is so engaged and really engaged with the local neighbours and making sure that they're engaged with what they're doing and what they're trying to achieve, and, you know, communicating with those people around the challenges that they have, but they are investing. And I'm really happy to say that, you know, I think we'll see Wakefield Pope opened in the new year, and it will be a force of nature in the motorsporting industry in just getting, I think it's going to be one of the best venues and tracks in New South Wales and possibly in Australia. And I know the member for Bathurst will probably disagree with me, but, you know, I'm pretty excited about what the future holds.
Just in terms of the compare and contrast, I guess, the men's Labor opposition announced, I think, a $1 million investment in noise mitigation measures for the track to allow it to reopen. The coalition announced a much larger sum. Has there been any indications from the Labor government that they would match that larger sum?
No. They've only allocated the $1 million that they promised, which is unfortunate. This redevelopment of the site is going to be a multi-million dollar project. And, you know, that $5 million that we announced prior to the election was, you know, certainly a greater incentive for the owner to actually take on the business. Mm. And unfortunately, we didn't win, and the government now has only just allocated that $1 million. So it's unfortunate. I'd like to think that a part of their actual election commitment was to do a motorsporting strategy. So we still haven't heard where that's up to. There's nothing in the budget to do that. And I think it's really important going forward. We've seen issues with the speedway. We need to have a motorsporting strategy because it's so important to our economy in New South Wales, and particularly small communities like Goulburn. And it's important that we get it right because we have lots of enthusiasts out there. And it really is a great win for the economy if it's done right.
I must say, although this was always a privately owned track and not a government asset, I don't believe that the new owners would have come in and the future of Wakefield Park would look as rosy if you hadn't got involved in the way in which you had. So I think that's a great example of how you as a local member have made a difference.
Yeah, it's such an important track to our community. There's a long history, and a long history to the motorsporting community as well. And, you know, we had contact through our office far and wide, and it's such an important economy driving initiative as well, and our local businesses get a lot out of Wakefield Park, so it was an important thing to get right. And I'm pleased that we waited and we found the right solution to enable that to happen.
Well, well done on that. Well, Wendy, it's been great to have you on Macquarie Street Matters. You're a great colleague to have. That praise at the beginning of the podcast means that you're very likely to be invited back. But you're a wonderful friend. You're a great colleague. And thank you so much for the great way in which you're representing the people of Goulburn.
Thank you, Alistair, and well done for this podcast. Was it your idea? I'm not sure. But anyway, you know, you're doing a great job because it's important that we get the message out, and it's important for people to see how the New South Wales Parliament operates and the important work that we're doing up here. Yeah.
Thank you, Wendy, and thank you for being my guest this week on Macquarie Street Matters.
Thank you.
Well, Freya, I don't think I can remember a more tumultuous week in New South Wales for quite some time, if at all. It all started relatively gently with me giving the Scarfield Barwick oration, where I spoke about the rule of law and spoke about how so many elites now in the corporate world, in the trade union movement, politicians, and even the judiciary don't seem to respect the rule of law in the way that they had previously. And Sir Garfield Barwick, who was probably Australia's best lawyer ever, both as a barrister, as a member in the Menzies government, a minister, I should say, in the Menzies government, and also then Chief Justice of the High Court, the longest-serving Chief Justice, he had spoken about the rule of law and the importance of the rule of law. He'd spoken out against people who didn't respect the rule of law. And then we had only a few days later, we had violations of international law in the terrible atrocities that were committed on Israeli citizens. And then that unfortunately spilled over into New South Wales. And it all began in the Premier, in a well-intentioned way, agreeing to light the Opera House in the colours of Israel.
Mm.
No one could disagree, no one could reasonably disagree with that decision. But then it became clear that perhaps the necessary preparation for that decision had not taken place, and things unfortunately started unravelling from there. Now, what we do know is that the events of Monday night at the Opera House, last Monday night, they were actually on a day when the Premier was on leave.
Oh.
And there was actually an acting Premier in Prucar. We don't know why the Premier was on leave. What we do know is that on the Friday of that weekend, he was in South Australia campaigning for the Voice referendum. Now, whether he took a long weekend in South Australia, whether he had a family holiday, I haven't heard any explanation for why he wasn't actually dealing with what became an incredibly volatile situation on Monday, when it was announced that pro-Palestinian protesters would have a meeting at the town hall and that they would then march to the Opera House, which had been lit in the Israeli colours, and take their protest there.
Mm.
Now, we saw at town hall Mark Spiro, who was advocating for the Israeli civilian victims, he was actually the only person arrested on Monday. And the police say that he was arrested for his own safety, and I have no doubt that that was the case. Mm. But it did seem rather ironic. So what occurred was an illegal protest which proceeded, and this is all ironically relevant to the rule of law, an illegal protest because there were no permits under the Summary Offences Act. An illegal protest proceeded from Town Hall to the Opera House. At the Opera House, there were chants of the most offensive historical nature to the Jewish people having regard to the Holocaust, which I won't repeat, but which were to the effect of kill the Jews. Mm. There were other insults towards our Jewish people. Now, all of those are unlawful in New South Wales. They're breaches of our racial and religious vilification laws. The police had accompanied the protesters from Town Hall to the Opera House and were surrounding them.
Yeah.
And yet no one was arrested for any of that. Also, there were the setting off of flares at the Opera House, which also is illegal, and no one was arrested for that. So there was a complete disregard for the rule of law and a complete failure to enforce the rule of law at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what has subsequently come to, and so it's difficult to understand how that could be the case, given that, you know, we live in a country and a society which is governed by the rule of law, and we rely upon our government to enforce the rule of law in our city. Now, what we know is that those scenes at the Opera House made our local Jewish community, who are already traumatised, I mean, many of them have family and friends in Israel, incredibly fearful for their safety. We have reports of our Jewish community not feeling safe to walk the streets. We'll come to the universities in a minute. Mm. We've got reports of Jewish children not going to school, all because of those images on Australia's most iconic building, the Sydney Opera House.
Yep.
At the time that the protest was taking place at the Sydney Opera House, I was at a communal meeting at Masada College in St Ives, which is, you know, near my electorate. It's just outside of my electorate. And that started at about 6:45. It finished at around about 8:30. By the time I got home, I was getting messages from Europe about what had happened on the steps of the Opera House from people that I know in Europe who were quoting tweets and things that were already on social media all around the world. I mean, I don't think many people realise just that this wasn't just having a dramatic impact here on our local Jewish community, but was incredibly impactful on our international reputation as a country.
Mm.
We and my concerns for the rule of law caused me to go on to the Ben Fordham show and make some comments, and we might just play a clip of that.
Plans for another rally this weekend, one centred around Town Hall, another one being rumoured in southwestern Sydney. Alistair Henskins has used the open line as well. He's the Shadow Attorney General. Alistair, good morning.
Good morning, Ben.
We're now hearing from Chris Minns. He's just holding a news conference. In fact, I'll play a little bit of that right now because I'm being told that the Premier may have finally got the message.
Look, a couple of things. Firstly, the protest organisers have already proven that they're not peaceful. Shouting racial epithets at Jewish community members is not the definition of a peaceful protest. So the idea that they're going to commandeer Sydney streets is not going to happen. And I'm sure the New South Wales Police will make that clear this morning.
Okay, there's the Premier saying it won't be happening this weekend.
Well, it's good news that law and order is finally being recognised by the Minns government, because what we have seen has been absolutely outrageous. We've had people chanting on the steps of the Opera House, an iconic building representing Australia, effectively chanting death to the Jews. It's a complete disgrace, and it's about time Chris Minns showed some leadership on this.
It sounds like he's doing that this morning. Again, he says that he expects that New South Wales Police will make that declaration, but they're learning the hard way. This should have happened 48 hours ago.
Well, Paul Toole spoke to your radio station yesterday, the former coalition police minister, and he made it very clear that that would never have happened under his watch, would never have happened under a coalition government. It's about time this Minns Labor government showed some leadership and stood up for the harmony in our country, which is something that we're incredibly proud of.
Alistair, shouldn't they be knocking on the doors of the protest organisers today, like police did during COVID lockdowns, and saying directly to them that if you're going ahead and promoting this thing, you're going to be arrested?
Absolutely. The march was completely illegal the other night and the other afternoon. We've got racial vilification, we've got religious vilification laws. They are making a mockery of them, and it's about time the New South Wales Labor government started enforcing the law.
We appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ben.
Alistair Henskins, the Shadow Attorney General.
Now, we'll come back to some of the decision-making in a minute around Monday night, but you also, exercising your right to freedom of expression and also solidarity for the civilian victims. And let's, you know, I don't want to go into too much graphic detail, but it's fair to say that there were horrific murder and of not only adults but children, raping of women, setting alight of civilians, taking of hostages and killing of whole families, you know, the most, you know, events and acts which are beyond the human experience really of any of us were all happening there in Israel. And you chose to walk around my old university where I have 2 degrees and the university that you're studying at, the University of Sydney, Australia's oldest university, so the oldest place of Western learning in this continent, and what happened?
Yeah, well, I think it's probably better if I take it back a step. The best way I've heard these events in Israel described is as Israel's 9/11. And in many senses, it's probably more extreme than 9/11 because we're talking about hundreds of terrorists going house to house, butchering civilians for, I think there were terrorists on the loose inside Israel for over 3 days before they actually got them all out. So it's just beyond belief.
Well, can I just stop you there and just say that one of the rabbis on Monday night at the service that I went to in St. Ives described it as the greatest loss of life since the Holocaust. And you know, and that really gave me pause to reflect because, of course, my father was living in Europe during the Holocaust in the Netherlands as a teenager. He had friends who were Jewish who were exterminated. And it really kind of made me a bit angry to think 80 years later, you know, his son and his grandchildren are still seeing this happened at a time when he was in the Dutch resistance and tried to fight a state that would kill its own citizens in both its own country and in occupied. So, yes, 9/11, greatest loss of Jewish life since the Holocaust. It was dramatic.
It was an absolute tragedy. And similar story in my family. My grandmother was a Holocaust survivor. And that's impacted, I mean, certainly, you know, the way my dad was brought up, you just have an acute awareness of what's happened. And that's why the events of this past week have been so, honestly, I mean, it sounds a bit dramatic, but I do think it has been genuinely traumatizing for a lot of Jews, of course, in Israel, but even here in Sydney, seeing what's been happening on our streets. So on Monday, when that protest was happening, my dad and I decided to go to the pro-Palestine. And it's not, they say it's pro-Palestine, but it's not. It's pro-Hamas because the Palestinians are also suffering because of Hamas. Mm. Don't forget that. They've embedded themselves in the civilian infrastructure. Their daily lives are dictated by a terror organization. And as is the case in every single war, it's always the innocent civilians that suffer.
On all sides.
On all sides. Yes. And that's the problem, which is why when these people say it's pro-Palestine, it's not. If they were pro-Palestine, they would be uprooting and eradicating Hamas. Because those, like, what? So long as there is a terror group running Gaza, those people will not be safe. Mm. So that's the first problem. So my dad and I went to this pro-Hamas rally, and my dad, he was just there watching it because we are firm believers in freedom of speech. There are limits to that, but we thought, you know what? These people, they can come, say their bit, whatever.
It's not freedom of hate speech.
And that's the difference. So my dad brought an Israeli flag. He was not planning to actually unfurl it, but he heard men just in front of him start to chant, "Kill the Jews." It was at that point on the street, on the steps of St. Andrew's Cathedral, my dad's an Anglican minister, he decided to pull out his Israeli flag and start waving it. All of a sudden, all of the people turned around and he had like almost probably over a dozen big men start coming towards him. And so...
I've seen the video and I think an important detail to understand how menacing it was that a number of those men had sunglasses and scarves covering their appearance so that they could not be identified if they broke the law.
Correct. So, you know, when people are masking themselves, they do not plan for this to be peaceful. There's a reason they were covering themselves. Mm. So my dad started to fear for his safety and so hustled off, and they ended up chasing him up the street, all the way up Bathurst Street and onto George Street, and then he had to hide behind a police van while 20 men stood on the corner of the road of Bathurst and George looking for him, and the police weren't there. There were no police around that section in Town Hall Square to provide any protection to my dad. It was only once he got all the way up onto George Street, and then the police had to come and disperse the group of men that were looking to hunt down my dad. And he said, and my dad grew up in apartheid South Africa, campaigned against apartheid, was water cannoned, was, you know, had tear gas used against him. And he said he'd never felt so scared because all it takes is one person with a knife. And this group of people, they knew they were not there to be peaceful. And so that was what happened Monday. Then we went down to the Opera House after that whole ordeal and watched the lighting of the sails. But even when we were down there, we got down to the Opera House before the protesters, and we went to go to the steps of the Opera House, and the police stopped us and said, "Oh, no, 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 the Palestinians are going there. Your people are over there," and sent us to the other side, to the cruise ship passenger terminal. And we thought, "What do you mean? Who is this for? Is it not for the Jewish people? Or for people who want to stand in solidarity with Israel, who has experienced the most brutal terror attacks in its history as a country?" But no, the Jewish people were sent away from the Opera House to make room for the Palestinian protesters.
I mean, the unfortunate thing about all of this, you know, and it goes back to what you said earlier, which I agree with, is that it's always the innocent civilians who get hurt. So this is not what we will never be able to solve. The geopolitical problems of the Middle East. That's been beyond many leaders for a long time. But what you can do is stand up for some principles of basic humanity. Innocent civilians should not be murdered. They shouldn't be raped. They shouldn't be, you know, their children shouldn't be, you know, these are basic fundamental views of humanity, and that's really why, you know, cheering on those events, I think, is troubling. Now, what we do know now, or there seems to be a little bit of a better appreciation, is that on Monday, a decision was taken to allow the march at Town Hall, a pro-Hamas gathering at Town Hall, to go on to the Opera House. Now, what has occurred is, well, what we do know that is unambiguous is that after conversations with the Jewish leaders of the Jewish community, that they sent out an email to the Jewish community on Monday afternoon informing them that they had been advised that the Jewish community should stay out of the Sydney CBD. What is in contention is that within the Jewish community, several people believe that that was an instruction both personally from the police minister and also the police, but the police minister has now denied that. And so we can come to that, how that sort of unpicked itself later in the week. But, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But the fact of the matter is that the Jewish community were told to stay away from the CBD of their own city. So what happened was the management of this, The management of this entailed a correct gesture of lighting the Opera House in recognition of the victims in Israel, and then a complete undoing of it by an unlawful protest at the Opera House by people who were screaming racial and ethnic vilification of the Jewish community in the presence of people in authority with regard to the New South Wales government, and a failure of any leadership. Now, my view is that given that the Opera House is a peninsula, it would have been a relatively easy thing, if there had been the political will to do so, for the riot police to have prevented any access to the Sydney Opera House on Monday night.
Yep.
And so therefore you would not have had what appears to be the confusing and mixed messages of lighting the Sydney Opera House, which is a very peaceful, non-active statement, but accompanied by hate speech on Australia's most recognisable building with flares going off that then goes all around the world. And I suspect that the people who have seen that would not have even known that the Opera House was actually lit in the Israeli colours. So it's achieved exactly the opposite by allowing the protesters access to the Sydney Opera House, which appears to have been, which, and I should say, Paul Toole, who was the last police minister in the coalition government that just finished in New South Wales, he went on radio and made it very clear this week that that would never have happened under a coalition government. And I don't think that there is any doubt that anyone in New South Wales would think that that would have occurred. The police minister was asked this week in Parliament what her powers were. She had absolutely no idea what her powers were as the police minister. Under Section 8 of the Police Act, the minister has the power to make directions to the police service, to police force. She can say, I do not want them accessing the peninsula which houses the Sydney Opera House. This is not a lawful assembly. They should not have access there. But they seem to have been completely unprepared for what was a relatively predictable occurrence given that the Opera House was being lit.
Yeah, 100%. And as soon as all of this, all of the conflict going on in Israel started to emerge, there were calls on Twitter, on social media for people, for a pro-Palestine, pro-Hamas rally to occur. Like, they would have had at least, you know, 24 to 48 hours of notice. And if you can't protect Jewish people in Sydney in 2023, and they are the ones, while their friends and family back in Israel are experiencing horrendous acts of terror, they are the ones that have to hide from the streets of Sydney. I think it's disgraceful.
Well, it's certainly not, I think, the country that most people want. We want people to leave their issues back in the country that they've come from, and to come and live in Australia in a harmonious way, respecting the rule of law and respecting, you know, the rules that we have in this great country of ours.
Correct.
And, you know, one of our great strengths is our diversity and our harmony, and we don't want anyone really to be compromising that. I should note, though, that the predictability of the protest on Monday was clear because there had already been a rally elsewhere in Sydney where there'd been very inflammatory statements rejoicing in what had occurred in Israel. So it was entirely predictable that there would be a response to the lighting of the Opera House within the CBD, and that needed to be managed by government.
Correct.
And anyway, it wasn't.
No.
Now, whether that was because the frankly, the police minister, who's also the Minister for Counterterrorism in New South Wales, is completely not up to the job, or whether it's because Chris Minns was on holiday when he should have been actually looking after one of the most significant events in at least recent New South Wales history, but instead he was on leave, is not entirely clear. But clearly it is a government that is in disarray. Now, now what happened in Parliament this week, and we'll get to what happened to you and Sydney Uni in a minute, but what happened in Parliament this week was that the Coalition asked the police minister, would she apologise to the Jewish community?
Mm.
She wouldn't apologise. She would not apologise. It wasn't until she was given several opportunities to apologise to our local Jewish community for the, you know, and she wouldn't do it. Now, Chris Minns had to get up in a press conference and apologise, but she would not apologise to Parliament, the Minister for Police, having regard to the terrible scenes at the Opera House on Monday evening. So that was the first thing. Now, the there was, of course, great consternation within the Jewish community. And of course, if communications occur between the Jewish leadership and a minister of the Crown on such a contentious issue, then, of course, what transpired when it happens, because the instruction for the Jewish community not to go to the Sydney CBD was such a remarkable instruction that there was a degree of discussion within the Jewish community. And we know that the Jewish community's view is very clear that the police minister, Yasmin Catley, advised the Jewish community, who we also understand their leadership pleaded with her not to allow the pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian march to proceed to the Opera House because that would completely undo the lighting of the Opera House. That she refused that request, and that she personally endorsed the community, the Jewish community, should stay out of the Sydney CBD, and communicated that to them, and there's been a degree of detail that's come out by Shari Markson on Sky News, but it's quite clear to me and to everyone else that the credible information is that the police minister made that direction. Now, she was asked a question by Paul Toole, the last coalition police minister. The police minister, Yasmin Catley, denied telling the Jewish community what several people understand to be the case, which is that she did that very thing. Now, the Jewish community at this time wants to have a close relationship with the New South Wales state government to enable it to feel safe. They have no reason to have lied about this.
No.
They had no reason to be saying that well before the police minister made that statement to the parliament.
Mm.
And so you've got a situation where the Jewish community don't have any motivation to lie about the matter.
Not
in fact, they have no interest in trying to bring down a minister in the New South Wales Minns government. They want close relations. So do you either believe what credible information from the Jewish community says, or do you believe the police minister? And I think the clear position is the police minister is fighting for her political career. People tell me that she was shaking in Parliament during question time when she was being asked about these matters. She clearly didn't know about her powers. She has misled Parliament on her conversations with the leadership of the Jewish community. And Mark Speakman, the leader of the opposition, has called for her resignation or dismissal. But as at the time that we're having this discussion, at least, she's still the police minister and the minister for counterterrorism in New South Wales.
Doesn't make you have a lot of faith in the government.
Well, at a time when we need a strong government,
correct,
we don't seem to be getting it. And the ultimate responsibility, of course, the one person that has put Yasmin Catley in there as police minister is actually Chris Minns.
Mm-hmm.
He picks the cabinet and he puts people in their position. We also had Michael Daly, the Attorney General. So he is the minister responsible for the administration of the Summary Offences Act, which is the very act that regulates lawful protest in our state. Mm. Right? He went on Ben Fordham on Tuesday morning. Oh. He didn't even know
what had happened
at the Opera House the night before.
It was embarrassing. Well, and he just told, and he was also echoed the calls for the Jewish community to just stay home. He was like, oh, I think everyone should stay at home.
So the only, so our public streets are not safe under this New South Wales Labor government.
But it's like, whose fault is that?
Exactly.
Whose job is it to guarantee the safety of our community?
Now, it's not he is the Attorney General, is not responsible for the police response.
No.
But one would have thought, given that he is the minister responsible for the administration of the Summary Offences Act and also the minister responsible for racial vilification and hate speech and religious vilification in our state, one would have thought that he would have been on top of the events of Monday night, just as my friends in Europe were on Monday night. One would have thought he was aware of what occurred by Tuesday morning when he went on Ben Fordham.
It's embarrassing. Clearly there's some serious breakdown going on in the Minns government.
Well, it's a real concern because, you know, as a minister, and I've had the privilege to be a minister in government, you have to respond to events very quickly. And clearly this is a government that has led in its saddlebags. Unbelievable. So then after Yasmin Catley denied giving the advice to the Jewish community that she clearly had given, we then had Shari Markson say that she'd misled Parliament, giving a whole lot of detail about the conversation and what had taken place and how some of the offensive way in which she'd referred to the Jewish community as you people and so on. And so Shari Markson reported those matters. I certainly didn't know anything about that. I'm not sure that the police minister has actually denied that. Mm. Saying that, she certainly gave out a statement denying that she misled Parliament on Thursday night. And so that's, you know, I think the bottom line is this minister has to go.
Yeah.
Now, on a separate but related matter, you then at Sydney University, can you just explain what happened there?
So I was at university on Wednesday and wanted to show my support for the innocent Israeli victims and civilians, people who'd suffered under the acts of terror that we'd seen over the last couple of days. And so to do that, I decided I would wear an Israeli flag around campus and, you know, just went about my business. Anyway, I accidentally walked past a pro-Palestine stall that was being run by the Socialist Club and the Muslim Students Club. And so I thought, whatever, I'm just going to walk past, not say anything. They can be there just as much as I can be there. It's all fine. As I walk past, I get screamed at. I get shouted down and they start leveling a whole bunch of slurs at me, saying that I'm supporting an apartheid state, saying how could I support a racist country, occupation, basically all the classic lines that these people try to use. And they started like following me and screaming at me. And I just kept walking and then I turned around because they were going at me and everyone was watching this happen. So I turned around and said, well, by standing here and supporting Hamas and saying that this is rightful resistance, you are saying that you are supporting the acts of terror that we've seen unleashed across civilians in Israel, and that includes the beheading of babies, the raping of women, kidnapping of children. And so I said, well, shame on you, and I just kept walking. And so that was honestly absolutely horrible to see, that at Sydney University you can't even walk around openly supporting innocent Israeli civilians without being yelled and screamed at by other students wearing, by the way, kafirs, which is what members of Hamas wear, and it's been associated with terrorist groups. And it's extremely intimidating to see that. And they had a sign out there saying Palestinians are right to resist. And that is essentially saying what they're characterizing what has happened over the last few days as rightful resistance. What's happened over the last few days has been terrorism.
Mm.
That they're justifying that.
Well, it certainly wasn't defensive. It was an attack.
Correct.
So that, you know, I mean, you know, my father, as I said, was in the Dutch resistance during the war. Mm. That was completely
genuine resistance.
Completely different. But yeah. Well, and so what was the reaction from the university to you raising these issues?
So myself and a number of other students, because other Jewish students saw what had happened or heard what had happened and found me throughout the day and said, thank you for standing up to them. And similar things have happened to me, and they relate stories of how they would refuse to take the pamphlets or they'd rip them up, and then they would also be targeted and harassed for doing so. And multiple complaints were submitted to campus security, and they did nothing. And they said, well, you know, they have a right to be there. But in the student charter, you cannot bully or harass people, let alone on the basis of religious affiliation. And so there seems to be a bit of a, I'm not sure if it's a double standard or just failure to apply the rules.
Unfortunately, it's a consistent standard at Sydney University, because we've seen the Liberal Club being forced to pay for its own security to have guest speakers at Sydney University in the past, and the university enforcing that cost on people who want to peacefully meet because radical socialists want to have violent protests preventing their meetings. We've seen that in recent history. I think even Malcolm Turnbull, when he came to visit Sydney University, was protested. I think John Howard has in the past. So it's unfortunate, because former Chief Justice of the High Court, Michael French, wrote a report about the state of free speech at Australian universities. If we can't have free speech and the free expression of ideas, not hateful speech, I might say, not violent speech, you know, even in the United States, where they have a constitutionally enshrined right to freedom of speech under the First Amendment of the Constitution, ever since that amendment was made in the 1800s, it's been very clear that you cannot use that protection for hate speech.
Mm.
You cannot incite people to violence.
Yeah.
It doesn't protect seditious expressions of views. These are outside of the protection of freedom of expression, and people who intimidate those or threaten those who are exercising their right to free expression are breaking the law.
Yeah. No, it's pretty bad. And this, the state of this on our campuses as well, it's horrible.
It's
and
not just Sydney Uni.
No, it's across the board, 100%.
I think there were complaints by Jewish students at UNSW as
Macquarie
well.
Macquarie University, where they were handing out sweets and playing music, which, by the way, is what they do in Gaza and the West Bank when there's been a successful terror attack against Jewish civilians. And so this has been very, very distressing for Jewish students, not just Jewish students, all students who want to stand up for the rights of innocent people to live peacefully.
And the shame of all of this is that there are so many wonderful, peaceful people within our Muslim community here that we shouldn't be taking sides in terms of what's happening in the Middle East, other than the side of humanity and the belief that innocent civilians should not be murdered, that there shouldn't be acts of terrorism. And what occurred recently on the weekend is completely outside of the bounds of acceptable conduct by anyone. You know, what we don't want to do is end up in a situation where any community is being vilified or tainted by one or two people who might, or more than one or two, but you know, a small minority who do the wrong thing. And it's really important that the leadership of all of our communities are very clear on that and try and dial things down. But incredible scenes. We can't say that in any sense this has been managed well.
No.
it's a time when leaders generally have to step up and actually defend the rule of law and defend the rules that we have, because those rules actually ensure or give protection for the harmony that we all want within Australia and within our society.
And it's particularly sad. So myself and a few other Jewish students are organising a table to be set up on Eastern Avenue at Sydney University on Monday, so when this podcast is released. And I've had Jewish students contact me asking if that was a good idea because they were genuinely concerned about their safety.
Mm.
That's what is happening. Jewish students on our campuses are so concerned about their physical safety at university for just openly identifying themselves as Jewish or as supportive of Israeli civilians that they feel like it is dangerous for them to even appear anywhere associated with that.
Well, I think, as I said earlier, unfortunately, that's happening more broadly within the Jewish community, where, you know, children aren't going to school.
So sad.
And there's been heightened security around synagogues and schools and other places of, you know, where Jewish people congregate. Look, I should also note that on Wednesday night in Dover Heights, we both went to, with, you know,
10,000
others, to a commemoration by the Jewish community and others. There were a good representation of elected officials. We had Mark Butler representing the federal government, Peter Dutton and Susan Ley, the leader and the deputy leader of the federal opposition, were also there. We had Premier Chris Minns, leader of the opposition Mark Speakman, a whole lot of other ministers and shadow ministers in New South Wales, also there, local members of Parliament, obviously in the eastern suburbs as well, Kelly Sloan, the member for Vaucluse. And so, you know, that was, I guess, a great way to just peacefully gather and denounce the atrocities and really speak, you know, for peace. Because all our local Jewish community want is peace and safety. They don't, you know, they don't want anything more than that.
And every Australian citizen is entitled to.
Correct. And I don't think that's an unreasonable position to take, and that they want to feel safe.
Correct.
And of course, one of the problems with what happened on Monday night is that the Opera House is incredibly close to their community.
Mm.
And look, we've seen a few other incidents as well. But anyway, and of course, we're recording this in advance of the weekend, where there is suggested to be another pro-Palestinian protest in Sydney on Sunday, which we can probably talk about in next week's podcast and how that goes. But I think what we want is a harmonious and peaceful and safe society that respects the rule of law, and it would be good if we can all come together to achieve that outcome. Well, thank you for having a chat about that.
Thanks, Alistair. I wish it was in better circumstances.
I know. But anyway, that's life. Yeah. And we'll look forward to next week's podcast.
I know you. You know me.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of Macquarie Street Matters, and I look forward to you joining us again next week.